Merci beaucoup, beaucoup, Jody. Maybe the three speakers want to come and sitting at their respective place in front here. And we have about half an hour for questions. Monsieur. Well, if I hear you, yes. If I don't, no. I can hear you.
Can you use the microphone recording? Huh? Can you use the microphone? Your video recording?
Sorry, you should use the microphone, apparently, because of the recording of the session.
Does your database include information on that sort? For instance, if the laws have actually translated into practical outcomes, or maybe countries where they have a building block of different laws that are similar and would be the best, most efficient countries to target for change that would actually translate to practical outcomes?
So we think of it as having a few different steps in terms of trying to get implementation on the ground. It's pretty clear to us from the evidence base, and this includes the evidence base being interviewing tens of thousands of workers in country, that when you have no laws on the books, people are clearly worse off. I state that even though that should seem obvious, because there are some countries that argue that they do better without laws. The United States is one example. They say, well, it's all passed voluntarily in the private sector. In fact, if you compare the United States to European countries, they do much, average workers do much more poorly without laws. It's also the case that there's much more implementation in poor countries than people realize. So, you know, we looked at whether it's Vietnam or Botswana and what happens when you have laws on the books. And again, they're helpful there. So there are two, but the next step is for sure making sure that once you have laws that they're actually implemented. We hope, we would love to have data collected globally on the extent of implementation. We don't have it. We're not aware of anybody who does. We do hope that people starting to know what's on the books in their countries will help with that process. I can tell you that I've traveled in about 60-plus countries, and many of the countries I've been to for work, people don't actually know, including experts in the field, what the laws are in their books. Making that transparent and easy to ask for implementation, we think, is a critical step. But the last thing you raised, the informal sector, some of these countries have a much larger informal sector than others, but many of these laws, it's possible to apply to the informal sector. So maternity and paternity leave, this is typically social insurance, can be covered for the informal sector. About a half dozen countries around the world automatically have mechanisms for applying their laws to the informal sector.
Hi, Keisha Rosan, UBC. So I have a question for you, Peter. One of the arguments and pushbacks that I see anytime we talk about global health is that using the taxpayers' money of Canada for global issues when we have severe issues in Canada itself. So, and you know I'm a big proponent of global health or I wouldn't be here. But my question to you is how do we address that issue from an optics point of view when we talk to the taxpayers of Canada? Thanks.
Sure. Well, I think it's an excellent question, and I think it goes beyond optics to substance. I mean, firstly, I made the point in my talk that I think Aboriginal health is an important proof point for global health. I think if we aren't paying serious attention to Aboriginal health, then our efforts in global health are somewhat delegitimized. Not to mention the fact that there are interventions where you can think about approaches to both. So, for instance, in the Global Alliance for Chronic Disease, a very exciting initiative that Michael mentioned, some of those RFPs are actually, potentially targeted to low- and middle-income countries, and I don't remember what the exact language is, but low- and middle-income communities within rich countries. So we often think about these as two separate things, and they're the same thing. So I think that's a substantive point. Secondly, I think a substantive point, let me frame this in terms of healthcare costs. You know, we often think about this in terms of north to south learning, and we don't think enough about south to north learning and south to north innovation. Well, explain to me why bypass surgery costs $100,000, $200,000, I don't know the exact cost, in our major cities. And in India, it's $20,000, $25,000. You know, in a globalizing world, when we're facing those sort of cost escalations, and this is a point I think you made, Henri, the south-to-north learning, particularly around innovation, both technological innovation, health systems innovation, business model innovation, I think is only going to increase because there's a lot more innovation on cost points in India and China than there is in Canada at the moment. We can benefit from that. So that's a second point. The third point is the commercial point that Henri made, which is it's a globalizing world, and you can't win by hogging the whole value chain. We need to figure out our point in that knowledge value chain, go with partners. And, you know, the work that Henri is doing and that ISTPC is doing is going to make our children more prosperous 15 years from now. So is that global health or global science, or is it local? You can't separate. And then finally, and I think one could talk longer about this, but I won't. Now, finally, I think there's very serious security considerations. So a friend of mine who was involved in disarmament studies, actually disarmament talks on biosciences between the United States and the Soviet Union, described to me an episode when he was in the U.S. Army at that time. He worked at U.S. AMRID. And he described to me an episode when he was meeting with the biological scientists in the Soviet Union back towards the end of the Cold War. And they had the heads of the political delegations who were essentially diplomats at odds, fighting. And then they said, you know, Colonel X, the U.S. one, and Colonel V, the Soviet one, could you go back and sort this out for us in the back room? And in fact, they did. There are certain bonds between scientists that don't exist between diplomats. And so I think actually there's very important security considerations. So in summary, technological, commercial, social, security, and I just didn't want to do a whole exegesis here, but I think there's a million points. And maybe just in closing, ask the young people. I mean, where do you think the demand is for global health? It's on the part of bright young people in our campuses who understand that the world is changing. And so if our politicians need any more evidence than that, they just need to focus on the bright young people. And I think actually the Government of Canada is responsive to these forces, as Henri's example gives, as some of the other examples Michael gave gives. And by responsive, I mean, of course, partially responsive and hopefully increasingly responsive in the future.
Is this on? To be completely crass, some people would call it business development in a roundabout way.
Hi, my name is Mark Weinberg, and I have two questions. One is to Henri, and it relates to the fact that the graph that you showed with China as an example, where the numbers of international collaborative papers seem to have gone down, might be interpreted in one sense as a kind of natural progression. That is to say that as China has developed a huge infrastructure in regard to research accomplishment, the need for collaboration internationally has probably also diminished in relative terms, making individual Chinese enterprise much more self-sufficient in the context that it might not have been 10 or 15 years ago. So I thought I could ask you to comment on that, and then I'll try to make another point.
I think in absolute numbers, the amount of the number of collaborative research programs, projects, initiatives done between Chinese researchers and counterparts internationally has risen significantly. It's a percentage that the graph showed.
That's what I understood, yeah. The percentage.
Yeah, and what I think it shows, but I frankly this is pure conjecture on my part, and it would be a worthwhile task to try to analyze it, and maybe to get your perspective looked at as well. But my sense is this: the absolute number is the growth in absolute number of scientists doing research at all, whether in partnership or not in partnership, is growing dramatically. I would hazard a guess that most of the new, younger researchers still don't speak English and are new to the research field, are yet relatively younger, and younger researchers collaborate less, relatively speaking, than older researchers. So what you're seeing the early part of a curve, and this is why my guess is 10 years from now, you're probably going to see a dramatic rise in international collaboration. But it's also true that it's not a simple, there's not a simple explanation, and probably a combination of what you said and what I'm supposing and perhaps other reasons come into it. When you have such a dramatic rise, the early numbers need to sift themselves out for a while.
So my second point relates to the fact that I am personally delighted to be able to benefit from an ISTP-funded project.
As are we.
In collaboration with China. But having said that, I think the points that all three of you have made in regard to globalization are very valid. And Henri in particular made allusion to the fact that the ground has shifted and continues to do so, meaning that in many respects we've been moving away from a classic peer review system of judging excellence to factoring in a whole bunch of other things that it seems to me must affect the daily management and life of the universities that we live in, such as McGill. And I guess my question is this necessarily a good thing? Maybe the pendulum, you know, has to go a bit in the opposite direction from where it had been, but really, do we want that pendulum to keep going off and then have to stick out there in left field for a long lot of years before starting to come back to some happy middle ground?
I think with the with the jewel comes a bit of a curse, according to all the old fairy tales. My sense is, if you look at the profiling of the billions of dollars that have been added to the enterprise of science in this country, the majority of it is still peer-reviewed, science quality-based research supported, the vast majority of it. What you're seeing, however, is an additional burden of results-driven research, immediate results-driven research, which put a greater burden of accountability and less of a weight on the peer review, pure science, or traditional science criteria. The good news for the science community is the government, for whatever its reasons, has clearly, not just our government, but governments around the world, have clearly seen the enterprise of science as a source of economic comparative advantage, to use a jargon. That's the good news. The bad news is the government has seen it as a source of comparative advantage. And with it comes a burden that the universities, certainly in this country, much less than in the United States, I would gather, are used to. They're not used to playing this role. And, for instance, the role of offices of technology commercialization in universities is, I don't know if it's growing, but it's certainly, there's greater pressure on them to deliver results. And, but Mark, in answer to your question, I would still say that the majority of the funds available for science in Canada are available under the old terms. You're just seeing an additional alphabet soup of programs, that have added components to them.
Eliane Paligero. I just would like to say the talks were all brilliant. I have a burning question for Henri about Israel and the Canada partnership. Israel produces a lot of really interesting technologies that can be of use in developing countries because of their expertise in semi-arid conditions and just trying to work with little water. There's a lot of expertise that could be transferred elsewhere. And Israel has a great technology transfer system in terms of the universities and research centers. How can that work and help Canada in accessing and helping nations that are low and middle income countries?
One of the things we've done at ISTP Canada is launched a triangle, Israel, China, and Canada, in the area of agro-innovation. By agro-innovation, meaning application of advanced systems in breaking new ground in agriculture. What China's particularly interested in, and India has asked to be part of that triangle, making it a quadrangle. Just to give you an example, Israel recirculates something like 65% of all the water it uses. The second country on that scale is, I believe, Spain at 19%. Vice governor of Shaanxi province in China, which is the province in which the city of Yangling is, which is the center of agro-innovation of China, has indicated to me that if China could reach 50% of Israel's level, it would transform the economy of China and transform the agricultural situation, not only in terms of volume, but in terms of quality of the food that it produces. So the issue of, and how does Canada gain? Because Canada brings an element of technological know-how to this triangle that neither Israel nor China possess. It's a complement. It's a complementarity. There's another thing, and it gets back to the point that Peter made. Canada is a very good convener of research partnership. As corny as it sounds, we play by rules. Our rules are transparent. We have good science. We are uniquely positioned also from a demographic point of view to combine three countries like the ones I mentioned. And so this triangle is actually starting to pay off dividends. We've had a three-way call for proposals. We have 26 projects in the pipeline, three-way projects in water and agricultural innovation. We are going to launch a similar program with India and Brazil. Canada is a good technology hub, and it could actually marry some of the objectives we heard in terms of bringing advanced technologies, better health systems, by actually transforming the integration that we can do in Canada and other parts of the world.
I'm a pediatrician from Montreal, and I'd like to bring back the discussion to Canadian society issue and about our tax money. For the last three decades, there are lots of talks about inaccessibility of healthcare to refugee, new immigrants, and transcultural issues are hotly debated. So with my own experience, in the 25 years ago, there was I noticed it was very low breastfeeding rate and lots of health problem among the new Chinese immigrant community. So spent lots of effort working with community action group, develop a perinatal program. But to make this story short, it was very welcome because nationally cross-cultural issue was popular then. And after it was developed and was run, and they took the program to the clinic where they want to get credit. After 10 years, when policy change, healthcare costs cut, so that program was discontinued within 1 month. And it took me and, you know, like with lots of persuasion. And finally, it has to be run by privately funded charity funding to carry on this perinatal program. And we know that this is vital for maternal child health and lots of other issues. So I'd like the panel to interject how we can work with politicians in policy making.
I'm sure other people have stuff to say too, but I guess I'll just make a few notes on this link between Canadian health and these global health issues. One is just to support what you have raised by saying that as a country of immigrants, you know, a country that has a quarter of its population is immigrants and in some cities much higher, there's an enormous piece of learning that has to do with understanding global health that has direct relevance to local health issues. The second, just building a little more concretely on, Peter mentioned south to north learning, and I just want to give one of my favorite examples there. Anybody who's worked in a neonatal intensive care unit knows that what we produce best is million-dollar babies. These are early-born babies who then get incredibly expensive care to survive. Well, for a long time in North America, doctors were told not to let parents touch the babies. The notion was they were too fragile. You know, they were the size of your hand, and their heart rates were erratic, and they was easy for them to have bleeds on the brain, and so you shouldn't touch them. Then somebody did a study in Colombia that, lo and behold, surprisingly enough, the babies did better if they were held. Their heart rates were better. They had less emergencies. So south-to-north learning couldn't have been experimented on here because people would have said it was unethical. Very inexpensive intervention, which made a lot of parents happy that they could touch their parents, their babies. So, okay, so we have immigrant health. We have south to north learning. I want to mention the third example, which is these global comparisons, which I showed you, have important lessons for countries around the world. They also have important lessons for health here in Canada. One of the things one would see if you look closely at the maps is that while there's a right to breastfeed in 130 countries around the world, there's not in Canada. And that while sick leave, there is insurance in Canada for it, in many of the provinces you can't take it without risking losing your job in the first day. So I think there are these direct applications.
I mean, the only other point I'll add, and I took a crack at the taxpayer money thing before, talking about diplomacy, talking about security, talking about commercial examples, and our role in the world. But let me just say one thing, another concrete example of south to north, which is there is, and it's how boundaries are breaking down in some of these specific areas. There's increasing evidence that micronutrient deficiency from conception to age 2 yields not only the terrible scourges I was talking about, but actually chronic disease in later life, like diabetes and obesity. And that's early evidence, but it's very counterintuitive and something that has come up in not in studies in Canada, to my knowledge, but in studies of hidden hunger and micronutrient deficiency in the developing world. If you think about the rates of diabetes, for instance, in our Aboriginal populations and some of the nutritional issues in our Aboriginal population, that is the sort of evidence that can make a huge difference in the world. And, you know, there's, a good example of south-to-north learning, speaks to taxpayer investment, speaks to all sorts of things and breaking down barriers that we might think otherwise exist. Let me also go out on a limb. Obviously, I've been talking a lot about micronutrient deficiency between conception and the age of 2 because it's becoming so clear that that's such a critical window. And it's not an accident that, you know, when the Copenhagen Consensus got together and looked for cost-effective interventions in global health, a bunch of Nobel laureate economists, 3 of the top 5 things were related to nutrition, including some of these things. We've got a fantastic story of Sprinkles and Stan Zlotkin from Toronto, which is a huge success story. But I think there's more stuff that we need to get into here. And it talks about a post-ideological world where we're a little more pragmatic. So we've talked a lot about breastfeeding. And there's no question that the most important intervention is to raise breastfeeding rates. So a 19% rate of breastfeeding, for instance, in Vietnam or Cambodia ain't going to do the trick in terms of saving lives. Early initiation of breastfeeding, exclusive breastfeeding to 6 months of age. But we haven't given enough attention to complementary feeding because, as you know, at 6 months, breast milk alone is insufficient. You have to continue breastfeeding to age 2 is the WHO recommendation. But breast milk alone is not sufficient to meet the needs of the growing baby. So then you can have either home-based gruels and complementary foods, some of which are nutritionally deficient, or affordable commercially produced foods. So, you know, this is a really interesting example where what you actually need is public-private cooperation collectively to get optimal breastfeeding and optimal complementary feeding. What you've got is a public-private war, initiated for good reasons, going back to the boycott of a major food company 30 years ago, but perpetuated. So, you know, there's an example of something that's playing out in the developing world that is actually killing lots of kids, or if not killing them, it's supposed to be behind about a third of the 9 million deaths of children under 5 in the developing world. If not killing them, locking them into a life of decreased human capital. And, you know, there are examples there learning about that dynamic in the developing world that I think could also be of benefit. So, you know, I guess I've just tried to give two concrete examples of South to North learning, thinking about things freshly. You can't do that by only looking inwards. And in closing, you know, our immigrant communities are our greatest strength. My parents came to Canada in 1956 from Hungary, and one of the great things about Canada is the ability of immigrants to thrive, and that's a huge asset that we have, and that's why I was so interested in Henri's statistic, that one-third of either your applicants or your successful grants with Canada-China were Canadians of Chinese origin.
Same ratio. Two-thirds in both.
Yeah. So, a bit of a long-winded answer, but I did want to give... Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah. But the examples I gave, in closing, you know, if we were only looking domestically at social policy or at issues in Canada, we would not be gaining the insights of long-term chronic disease from short-term undernutrition, the need for public-private cooperation in the space, the role of immigrant communities in the sort of linkages that Henri, it's a globalizing world, and we need to be able to see it as such, and there's three concrete examples.
One more question, perhaps?
I was just wondering, we know that in order for global health to be sustainable, we need collaboration from the local governments and local countries. What I was wondering is, we know that also that the education perhaps outside of China and Brazil and Israel, where there are universities that can successfully educate young individuals, a lot of places in Africa still do not have functional universities. I was wondering what Canada's role is in trying to educate people from developing countries and helping to bring them back to their own nations.
One of the things I would have said if Denis hadn't rushed me was that to me the next stage of programs such as the one we manage is to include, first of all, it makes no sense to have such a program with only four countries. And four, I don't know if I'd like to use the word representative, all countries are representative of something, but they're four unique countries. If you think of the countries of interest in global health, they're not the first four that come to mind, probably. And I think that for Canada to have a true global technology partnership program that has the balance that we've talked about, we would need an additional 6 to 20 that would include some of the countries that don't have the capacity that you just outlined in order for us to have a full service, full balanced approach. I don't know if that answers your question, but this is certainly something that for what little weight my opinion has, it's, that's where it's going.
I'll just add a couple of thoughts. I think one of the key things you raised was how do we educate people in a way that it's meaningful to return to their own countries. So that already puts a broader frame on that, because that has to do with not only the education period, but are there jobs to go back to? Are there research opportunities, innovation opportunities if they're in the sciences, social sciences? In professions, are there professional opportunities for them to go back to? I absolutely believe we have an obligation to help with the funding. And I just want to note a couple things on that. People have proposed a global fund for education that would look like AIDS, malaria, and TB in some respects. Until there is a global fund, it's impossible to imagine that the world's poorest countries, which have the least access to this education right now, are going to be able to fund it from the start. Part of that is not just an act of generosity. Right now, we actually do the opposite on education. So when Canada, when the UK, when other countries
recruit nurses, doctors, highly trained healthcare professionals from developing countries, South countries, and bring them here for health services or bring them to the UK. The countries are actually paying for their education, and then we're benefiting from it for healthcare. So I think a piece of the puzzle has to be returning some of those resources to train locally.
And I think the MDGs, which drive a lot of development agencies around the world, haven't adequately incorporated the role of higher education or science and technology. There is an educational MDG, but it's focused on primary education. And important as that is, there also needs to be a focus on higher education. And in terms of science and technology, it took a science, technology, and innovation task force of the Millennium Project, co-chaired by Kalestas Juma and Ishmael Sarah-Geldin, to really start to point out where the MDGs were maybe a little deficient in science, technology, and innovation. So I hope, Alex, to address your question, as the MDGs are refreshed, moving towards 2015, because they are a strong driver of development agencies in G8 countries around the world, I hope as the MDGs are refreshed, there will be higher education and science, technology, and education, science, technology, and innovation will have a stronger role, because that, at the end of the day, is the sustainable solution to countries' economic development if they don't have oil, or if they do have oil and they didn't abuse it. That's the only other alternative. Oh, the UN Millennium Development Goals that I referred to in my talk, these 8 goals that are, aimed to coordinate UN agencies and also have had a very strong influence on development spending over the last period of time. And they're sort of framed as targets to 2015. 3 of them are in health. 1 of them, I think, is in education. And they really do drive things in terms of development spending. And I think it's great that they're so focused. To some extent, it's great because it brought a certain discipline to the development space. But they do not adequately represent, in my opinion, the importance of higher education, science, technology, and innovation to countries in the South. And I think, Alex, that's underlying the point that you were making.
Okay, I guess we're coming to the end of our discussion on innovations in global health. Thank you very much to the 3 panelists. I think we're very fortunate to have access to your expertise. It was a pleasure moderating you, even Henri.